there. That does it for our broadcast. Democracy Now! Is hiring a development director to lead our fundraising efforts. Also an on-air graphics operator. You can go to our website at democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Carla Wills, Laura Gottesdiener, Dina Guzder, Amy Littlefield, Hermit Shea, Robbie Caron, Steve Martinez, Hani Massoud. I'm Amy Goodman with special thanks to Mike DeFilippo, Miguel Nogueira, Becca Staley, Julie Crosby, Hugh Grand, David Prude, Ariel Boone, John Randolph, Kieran Krugmeadows, and Tarina Ndura. Go to democracynow.org for transcripts, video, and audio podcasts. Thanks so much for joining us.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud sponsor of the We Real Cool film series at the Clinton Street Theater. This month is the amazing Nina Simone, showing Thursday, November 19th at 7 p.m. Nina Simone was one of America's true musical geniuses. With her unique signature mix of layering folk, gospel, classical, pop, and African music, along with a revolutionary vision of Black freedom, pride, and defiance. Again, that's the amazing and revolutionary Miss Nina Simone, showing as part of the We Real Cool film series on Thursday, November 19th at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Charles Adams Family and Friends, an art show of 52 original artworks by the creator of the Adams Family and beloved New Yorker cartoonist. The show is up through December 13th at the Saruman House, 5131 Northeast 23rd Avenue in Portland. Saruman House is open Thursday and Friday from 4 to 8 p.m. and Saturdays and Sunday from noon to 4 p.m. Again, that's Charles Adams Family and Friends, an art exhibit up through December 13th at the Saruman House in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, Governor Kate Brown announces that the state will continue to accept Syrian refugees.
A settlement has been announced in a lawsuit against the second largest for-profit college company.
And Wednesday, the City Council will begin discussing an initiative to level the playing field for job applicants with criminal backgrounds.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News. I'm Jared Dantzler.
And I'm Emily Young. Oregon Governor Kate Brown today said that Oregon would continue to admit Syrian refugees. Governor Brown's office made the announcement via Twitter. Her message reads, quote, "Clearly, Oregon will continue to accept refugees. They seek safe haven, and we will continue to open the doors of opportunity to them," unquote. And, quote, "The words on the Statue of Liberty apply in Oregon just as they do in every other state," unquote. A group of 30 governors, most of them Republicans, announced on Monday that they would try to block any Syrian refugees from coming to their states. Also on Monday, Washington Governor Jay Inslee and the governors of Connecticut, Pennsylvania, Colorado, and Hawaii stated that their states would remain open to refugees. It is doubtful that the state governors can actually call a halt to the refugee resettlement, so the moves are symbolic. U.S. House Speaker Paul Ryan, however, has called for the flow of Syrian refugees into the U.S. to be put on pause, and House Republicans have put together a task force to look into the refugee crisis.
This Wednesday, the city will have an opportunity to discuss for the first time an initiative to level the playing field for job applicants with criminal backgrounds. The push for legislation benefiting people formerly convicted of crimes follows a call from President Obama early this week. President stated, if the disclosure of a criminal record happens later in a job application process, you're more likely to be hired. The proposed Ban the Box ordinance would require most employers to wait until after hiring to ask about a person's criminal record. According to a report from the Justice Department, 60 to 75% of ex-inmates cannot find work within their first year out of jail. In June, Governor Kate Brown signed a measure in which places restrictions on employers from denying applicants an initial interview based on a criminal background. House Bill 3025 goes into effect the first of the year. The new law seeks to remedy in part the increasing number of unemployed young, poor, and minority community members looking for jobs these days. Portland Mayor Charlie Hales touted the law, but says it doesn't go far enough. Ban the Box was proposed by the mayor in March, alongside nationwide state initiatives. If you would like an opportunity to testify, hear, discuss the proposed measure, the place is City Hall. The time is Wednesday at 2:45 p.m.
A new short-term homeless shelter may open in Southwest Portland on Thanksgiving, following the City Council's approval last Thursday of a $1 million budget for the new shelter. Portland officials hope that up to 200 people will sleep there each night, doubling the capacity of the current largest shelters downtown. Initially, the shelter will cater exclusively to women, with plans to eventually accommodate couples. It will be a nighttime shelter open from 6 p.m. to 9 a.m. daily. A report in the Oregonian stated that the number of emergency shelter beds in Multnomah County dropped from 985 in 2008 to 478 last year. Transition Projects expects to hire 24 people to work at the shelter. The shelter will be open for 6 months. According to Josh Alpert, Mayor Hale's chief of staff, 6 months is the longest that the, quote, feds will tolerate, unquote, having a shelter in the space. The long-term plans for the Jerome Sears Army Reserve Center are to upgrade the building and turn it into an emergency response center for West Portland. But it still needs $12 million to make the necessary upgrades. The mayor's spokesman said that he plans to serve Thanksgiving dinner at the site.
As the Oregon legislature prepares a measure to increase the minimum wage, the biggest union in the state has joined the campaign to raise the wage. KBOO's Jenka Soderberg ran into Tom Chamberlain, the head of the Oregon branch of the AFL-CIO, about the union's campaign, as well as the Trans-Pacific Partnership and other issues.
I just wanted to, while I have you here, ask what you think the impact of the Trans-Pacific Partnership is going to be on Oregon workers.
On Oregon workers?
Yeah.
It's going to be a detriment. I mean, what you see today is just this drive to the lowering of wages and benefits. Whenever you create a labor force that makes significantly less benefits, you're going to have an impact on workers here in Oregon. And when we have to suddenly compete against Vietnam, for example, it makes things more difficult for us, and more people slide out of the middle class into lower wage jobs. We have an increase in homelessness. We have an increase on demands for social services, and at the same time, we're defunding those social services. No, it's not going to be good for the Oregon worker.
And what would be your message or the message of the AFL-CIO to Ron Wyden, who initially opposed it and then supported fast-tracking of the TPP?
Well, Senator Wyden, my message to him was that you promised that fast track was one issue and the TPP was another, and that you would not vote for a bad trade agreement. This is a bad trade agreement. They say there's labor standards in there, but there's no enforcement. So what good is having labor standards if you can't enforce them? He says that they say that there's economic standards in there, but again, you can't enforce them. So if you have an agreement that you can't enforce, what good is it?
And you recently had a convention here in Oregon. I understand that 15 Now was on the agenda. What's the status of that? Is the AFL-CIO going to push for a $15 minimum wage in the state?
We're going to push for the highest minimum wage we can possibly get. We supported 15 Now, and we supported another strategy to increase the minimum wage. The bottom line is, how much can we increase the minimum wage here in the state of Oregon?
And do you know of any efforts within the AFL-CIO to show solidarity with Palestinian workers by divesting the Israeli bonds that the AFL-CIO has?
I don't know anything about it.
Okay.
I have no idea.
Thanks.
That was KBOO's Jenka Soderberg speaking with Tom Chamberlain, the head of the Oregon AFL-CIO.
There are now officially 4 million people in Oregon. The Oregon population has increased by 51,000 in the past year. Most of the increase is due to people moving into the state. 54% of the growth was in the Portland metropolitan area. That's Multnomah, Clackamas, and Washington counties. Just two decades ago, around 1993, the Oregon population was only 3 million.
Hundreds of people gathered last Thursday inside the historic B reactor of the Hanford Nuclear Reservation to mark the creation of the Manhattan Project National Historic Park. The Hanford Nuclear Reservation, which is half the size of Rhode Island, is located on the Columbia River near eastern Washington, tri-cities of Pasco, Richland, and Kennewick, Washington, and for decades made plutonium for the nation's nuclear arsenal, beginning with the atomic weapons used on Japan. The B reactor, which was the world's first full-sized nuclear reactor when it was built in 1943-1944, employed more than 50,000 people during World War II. There is much positive spin put on the history, purpose, and value of the plant, but according to Wikipedia, many early safety procedures and waste disposal practices were inadequate in hindsight, and government documents have confirmed that Hanford's operations released significant amounts of radioactive materials into the air and the Columbia River. The article continues with the statement that, in fact, Hanford is currently the most contaminated nuclear site in the United States and is the focus of the nation's largest environmental cleanup. If not an attempt to shift the financial responsibility for cleanup conversation of the site into a national park, certainly seems to be a strategy for modifying public perception of the disastrous legacy that is Hanford.
And now we turn to the weekly commentary from Paul Cienfuegos for Community Rights and Dismantling Corporate Rule, produced weekly for the Tuesday Evening News.
Greetings. You're listening to the weekly commentary by yours truly, Paul Cienfuegos. Today is the fifth week in my series of commentaries that attempt to unveil the fascinating story and chronology of how the Supreme Court over the past 196 years has transformed the business corporation from an institution that was legally subordinate to the people, beginning after the American Revolution, into something having more constitutionally protected so-called rights than do you or I. Shall we proceed? Since 1886, every time human beings have won new rights, like in the Civil Rights Act of 1964, corporations became eligible for them as well. This does not bode well for the future of the United States as a democratic society, so we as concerned citizens absolutely must shift gears in our activist work and start to figure out how to dismantle these corporate rights before it's simply too late. But let's get back to the history lesson. In 1971, women finally got constitutional protections as persons under the 14th Amendment in the case Reed v. Reed. There were earlier cases where it was assumed that women had equal protection, but this was the first case in which the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment was ruled to apply to women, finally prohibiting differential treatment based on sex. Now, let's not forget, corporations won access to personhood under the 14th Amendment in 1886, but women didn't gain access to the 14th Amendment till 1971. That's 85 years later. No wonder corporations have so much legal and political power and women have so little. In 1976, in the case Buckley v. Valeo, the Supreme Court ruled that political money is equivalent to speech, that to limit how much a person can contribute to an election is to discriminate against their constitutionally protected right to speak, a truly unbelievable and appalling decision. The most prominent portion of the case struck down limits on spending in campaigns, which is when corporate persons started to drown our elections in their money. This is 34 years before the Citizens United decision, which some in the media claim is the beginning of massive corporate spending in elections, a claim that is clearly patently false. In 1976, in the case United States v. Martin Linen Supply Company, a corporation successfully used the Fifth Amendment to protect itself against double jeopardy to avoid a retrial in an antitrust case. Also in 1976, in the case Virginia State Pharmacy Board versus Virginia Citizens Consumer Council, the Supreme Court granted First Amendment free speech protections to commercial speech, From this point forward, advertising was now a constitutionally protected form of free speech. Oh my. In 1978, in the case First National Bank of Boston versus Bellotti, the Supreme Court ruled that the Free Speech Clause of the First Amendment prohibits a state legislature from restricting corporate contributions to influence the outcome of political referendums. Their decision overturned a Massachusetts law and state controls to limit corporate interference in state ballot initiatives unraveled rapidly after that. There was a significant dissent against the majority decision in this case by Justices White, Brennan, and Marshall, who stated, quote, "The special status of corporations has placed them in a position to control vast amounts of economic power, which may, if not regulated, dominate not only our economy, but the very heart of our democracy, the electoral process. The state need not allow its own creation to consume it," unquote. In 1978, in the case Marshall v. Barlow, corporations won access to the Fourth Amendment's right against unreasonable search and seizure. The case involved an electrical and plumbing installation business that objected to OSHA, the Occupational Safety and Health Administration, visiting their shop to check for safety violations, claiming that a court warrant should first be obtained. This decision has made it close to impossible for OSHA to do its job. In 1986, in the case Pacific Gas and Electric versus Public Utilities Commission, the court drastically expanded a corporation's First Amendment free speech rights by upholding the corporation's right not to speak and protecting the corporation's freedom of mind. The case involved a regulated utility company that was objecting to the extra space in their billing envelopes being used by consumer advocacy groups under the authority of the California government. There was a wonderful dissent by Justices Rehnquist, White, and Stevens, who stated, quote, to ascribe to such entities an intellect or mind for freedom of conscience purposes is to confuse metaphor with reality, unquote. I've been sharing with you an unveiling of the fascinating chronology of how the U.S. Supreme Court over the past 196 years has transformed the business corporation from an institution that was legally subordinate to the people, beginning after the American Revolution, into something having more constitutionally protected so-called rights than do you or I. We'll be continuing with this timeline for one final week next Tuesday. That's our sixth episode. You've been listening to the weekly commentary by yours truly, Paul Cienfuegos. You can hear future commentaries every Tuesday on the KABU Evening News in Portland, Oregon, and on a growing number of other radio stations. I welcome your feedback. You can subscribe to my weekly podcast via iTunes or at communityrightspdx.org. You can sign up for my twice-monthly updates at paulcienfuegos.com. You can follow me on Twitter at cienfuegospaul. Thanks for listening, and remember, we are the people we've been waiting for.
Listening to the KABU Evening News. Stay tuned for the KABU News in Depth. Doug McVeigh speaks with Rania Masri, an activist based in Beirut. The topic is the slanted media coverage of the Paris bombings. This will be followed by the F Word at 6, which will focus on the three queer black women who created the Black Lives Matter movements. At 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. The weather tonight will be rain and a low around 43. Tomorrow, more of the same with a high near 52. Today in history, in 1558, Queen Elizabeth ascends to the throne of England and the Church of England is reestablished. In 1885, the Serbian army with Russian support invades Bulgaria. And in 1993, U.S. House of Representatives passed resolution to establish the North American Free Trade Agreement, also known as NAFTA. And the world champion boxer Muhammad Ali reminds us that the word Islam means peace. The word Muslim means one who surrenders to God. But the press makes us seem like haters.
It's 5:19, time for a daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
People like trains. Whether taking a long trip or making the daily commute, riding the rails without the hassles of airports and the tensions of driving can be the most sensible and pleasurable way to get from here to there. Americans have been doing just that for 188 of the USA's 226 years. On horse-pull rail carriages in the 1830s, then going west on the steam-shrouded iron horse of the 1870s, next riding the Zephyr and other sleek streamliners of the 1930s, and today taking the electric high-speed Acelas running on some of Amtrak's routes. More than just another mode of transportation, trains have represented our people's can-do spirit and our yearning to go beyond where we are. And though the 19th century push to span the nation with rails came with huge human consequences, decimating native tribes and virtually enslaving many immigrant workers, the resulting system tied the country together and unified the economy. A century later, however, our national rail passenger system is a wreck. Highway builders, auto lobbyists, and airline monopolists have hijacked America's transportation policy. As a result, our mobility future has been clogged with their self-interest, blocking the rail travel alternative. It's shameful how our corporate and governmental masters of transportation have sidetracked what, not so long ago, was a world-leading cross-country train system and reduced it to an underfunded hodgepodge that's an insult to the traveling public and wholly inadequate for a nation with pretensions of greatness. This is Jim Hightower saying, despite attempts to kill the notion of a national rail passenger system, trains are only getting more popular. The U.S. High-Speed Rail Association has a map of what a national rail system could look like. Check it out at www.ushsr.com/USHSRMAP.
What do the corporate powers from Wall Street to Walmart have in common? They hate the Hightower Lowdown. You can see why at www.hightowerlowdown.org.
The U.S. Department of Education and the Justice Department announced yesterday that they had reached a settlement with the Education Management Corporation, the nation's second-largest for-profit college operator. The suit alleged that EDMC unlawfully recruited students by running a high-pressure boiler room operation and paying admissions personnel solely based on the number of students they enrolled. The agreement calls for EDMC to pay $95 million to the U.S. and to the states. During the time period in question, EDMC received a total of $11 billion in Title IX funding. Settlement of a second suit against EDMC, filed by a consortium of 32 state attorney generals, was also announced yesterday. That lawsuit involved allegations of consumer fraud, as well as deceptive and misleading recruiting practices. The settlement agreement for that suit requires EDMC to forgive almost $103 million in loans held by about 80,000 students around the United States, an average of less than $300 per student. $1,300 per student. Oregon is home to about 650 of those students. The settlement agreement also calls for EDMC to not engage in abusive or deceptive recruitment practices and to record and monitor calls to students made by its recruiters.
While colored-only bathroom signs are relics and being black no longer means that you have to sit at the back of the bus, African-American students at colleges throughout the U.S. say that in 2015 they are still dealing with more subtle forms of institutionalized racism. The University of Missouri has been at the center of protests calling for administrators to be more responsive when it comes to dealing with racial hostility on campus. Friction between students and the president of the university led to his resignation last week. FSRN's Lena Nozizwe reports that students around the country are also putting their administrators on notice, while critics don't understand why.
While detractors wonder why African-American students at the University of Missouri have been protesting, other students from around the country say they completely understand. So far, students and faculty at some 100 colleges and universities in the United States have expressed support for those at the university known as Mizzou. That support means that Missouri is not the only institution of higher learning where African-American students say they constantly face racial hostilities. And they say many school administrators are ineffectual when it comes to responding to their complaints. That includes the University of California, Los Angeles, where Hundreds of students of all races protested last week on the steps of the Powell Library.
We can't take it no more!
Echoing other universities, the UCLA students have also presented a list of demands to the administration, including increased funding for student programs, including an endowment just for African Americans. Students also want more black faculty members. Peter Hudson, associate professor of African American Studies at UCLA, supported the protesters.
As faculty, we're subject to the same forms of microaggressions, to use the word, the same forms of humiliations that you're subjected to as students, and we get them from students, from faculty members, and from the administration as well.
According to the U.S. Department of Education, UCLA and Mizzou are not outliers. In 2013, the number of black students at four-year research universities was substantially lower than their demographic population size in 49 out of 50 states, with West Virginia the only exception. At top-tier private universities, the disparity was even greater. Sue Cochran was in the crowd at the UCLA protest. She is the vice chair of the Academic Senate, and she says the campus has been trying to recruit more minority faculty members.
Students have a lot of issues that they're working with the administration on in terms of being sure that opportunities here are fair for everybody, and that that there are things that we can be doing to make this place more welcoming for folks.
Students at the University of Missouri have said that they feel unwelcome after years of incidents, including one where two white students placed cotton balls around the Black Culture Center, an allusion to slavery. And earlier this year, someone painted over the word black at the Culture Center. When Mizzou students recently questioned the then president about the fairness of the institution, things only got worse.
What do you think systematic oppression is?
Systematic oppression is because you don't believe that you have the equal opportunity for success.
You don't believe!
Last week, Tim Wolf resigned under pressure. The chancellor of the university also stepped down.
Did you just blame us for systematic oppression, Tim Wolf?
Stand up like that!
And in Los Angeles just last month, students staged another protest at UCLA. They demanded more support for black students after a sorority and a fraternity theme party that was offensive to many black students on campus. First-year political science student Tiffany Darden says following the party, she noticed that racial tensions increased. While critics say students like Tiffany are just being too sensitive, she says just walking in and around the campus can be a study in microaggressions.
Specifically on frat row, I think like college nights where it's like parties and stuff, my friend and I were walking, we're both African American, and the guy was like, yeah, I love chocolate, like, you know, giving us a high five, so things like that. Or recently over the weekend, like a guy did the phrase like, oh, like the darker the berry.
Are y'all ready?
Students here and around the country have clearly been influenced by the Black Lives Matter movement, and the familiar chant rang out at UCLA during the protest in support of Mizzou. Critics who refer to the Black Lives Matter protesters as thugs now call student activists whiners. First-year student Jarrett Lampley says he just wants to go to school without dealing with enmity.
I've had people use the N-word with me just openly. And obviously I'm a tall African-American male, so at a major institution, so I've had a lot of questions regarding, or are you here on a sports scholarship? Like, do you play basketball? Do you play football? And I don't fit in any of those categories, so I've dealt a lot with people kind of questioning my intellect just based on the fact that I'm a minority student.
A study released earlier this year by the Federal Bank of St. Louis found that the median net worth of college-educated blacks dropped by nearly 56% from 1992 to 2013, while their white counterparts saw an increase of 86% in spite of the Great Recession. Lampley understands what he faces after graduation, but like other college students around the country, he isn't willing to simply accept it. That, he says, is why he protests.
What do we do? Stand up like that!
What
class.
What do we do?
Stand up, fight back!
Latino Zizway, FSRN, Los Angeles.
For 12 days beginning at the end of November, Paris will host the 21st Gathering of Representatives over 190 countries to discuss climate change. The 2015 Paris Climate Conference, also known as COP21, will, for the first time in over 20 years of negotiations, aim to achieve a legally binding and universal agreement on climate, with the goal of keeping global warming below 2 degrees centigrade. The conferences, originally begun in 1995, have admittedly produced some agreements, but most have been non-binding, and some have been outright ignored. Recently, U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry made a statement that greenhouse gas reduction targets, as discussed in pre-conference meetings, will not be legally binding. The targets offered so far have also faced criticism from environmental groups, in part because it remains unclear how they will be enforced. Moreover, they don't put the world on track to limit warming to 2 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial levels, as scientists have agreed is necessary to avert the worst impacts of climate change. The conferences are having the effect of generating more investment in alternative energy solutions and increased interest in sustainable, small-scale, non-toxic food production.
Parisians woke up Monday morning under a state of emergency, imposed in the wake of a terrorist attack on the city on Friday. Many in the country are shocked by events that killed 129 people in 6 coordinated attacks in downtown Paris and a nearby suburb. The Paris attacks came just one day after 2 suicide bombers blew themselves up in a southern neighborhood of the Lebanese capital, Beirut, killing 44 people. The attacks represent an escalation in jihadist violence, and the self-declared Islamic State, or Daesh, has claimed responsibility for both. The attacks in Paris stunned many around the world, sparking reactions ranging from solidarity with those affected by the violence to fear of others who had nothing at all to do with it. The attacks come as hundreds of thousands of people are fleeing much the same violence in their home countries, resulting in a massive humanitarian crisis in Europe. Today in the U.S., at least 12 governors of U.S. states vowed to not take in Syrian refugees as part of a resettlement efforts, despite the fact that all of the attackers identified so far were either French or Belgian nationals. Back in France, the president has requested emergency powers for the next 3 months. FSRN's Khalid Sid Mohand reports from Paris.
Mrs. Azia was with her husband Friday night in their apartment on Rue de la Fontaine-au-Roi when she heard shots fired outside her window.
Around 9:25 p.m., I heard a terrible noise. I went to stand by the window and then I saw this man shooting with a huge rifle. But he was not firing in full automatic. He was shooting bullet after bullet. Pum, pum, pum. We eventually went downstairs because the police were out of reach. I eventually understood why. They were just busy all over the city and their telephone switchboard was overwhelmed. I saw 4 men lying on the ground. That's why we went down. 3 of them weren't moving anymore. They were curled up on the floor. And there was a 4th one who was still moving his hand from time to time. The man started shooting at 9:25 and the first emergency relief showed up 25 minutes later.
The attackers killed 5 people and severely injured 8 others in the attack Asia witnessed, which targeted customers at the Italian restaurants she lives above. At the same time, a couple of streets away, a man stepped out of a small black car and opened fire with an automatic rifle on crowds at the French cafe and the Cambodian restaurant, instantly killing 15 people before leaving the scene. Hours later, FSRN spoke with Samir Haddad, a 40-year-old owner of a nearby cafe.
I was clearing the terrace table. I saw a car driving in the opposite direction very fast and someone shoot at me. The guy aimed at me but missed. I heard the noise of the bullet ricocheting off the sidewalk before it fell on me. It was a stroke of luck. I was having a very bad day because I had to cancel a concert that was supposed to have taken place. But now I feel so relieved because when I organize these kind of events, they always draw many people, including children.
The attacks have left the city in a state of shock, and leaders quickly announced emergency measures that would have been unimaginable in lesser circumstances. In an extraordinary joint session of Parliament Monday, French President François Hollande pledged to eradicate terrorism and uphold the ideals of the Republic of France. Hollande has requested emergency powers for 3 months. The powers will include the authority to close the borders, restrict public gathering, and allow the police to conduct searches without warrants. Hollande says the attacks were carried out by 3 teams of 8 perpetrators. 7 died Friday night after detonating their suicide vests, but one remains at large and is the target of a massive ongoing manhunt. Not all the attackers have been identified, but at least 4 were French citizens. The suspect still at large, the alleged mastermind of the attacks, is a Belgian national. Prime Minister Manuel Valls said the French police have already carried out more than 150 raids in Bobigny, Lyon and Toulouse. The raids have resulted in 23 arrests and dozens of weapon seizures. The French government's reaction to the attacks extends beyond its borders. Over the weekend, French warplanes struck multiple targets in Raqqa, the Syrian city the self-proclaimed Islamic State claims as its capital. All the attackers identified thus far are European nationals. However, refugees fleeing the violence in Syria and Iraq are likely to pay a heavy price for the attacks in the form of scapegoating and restriction on asylum petitions. Just how the French government and the French people would react to the attacks in the longer term is still unclear, but a mix of fear, apprehension and xenophobia are in the air of what has long been one of the world's most diverse and cosmopolitan cities. Khaled Sidmohan for Free Speech Radio News, Paris.
Snow. It's beautiful, and it's fun to play in, but it's also vital to the water supply of some 2 billion people in the Northern Hemisphere. As global warming continues and increases, snowfall and the meltwater it generates will very likely decrease in the coming years. A study from Columbia University shows a 67% likelihood that snow will decrease in the next century. Areas most sensitive to the United States include northern and central California and the mountains feeding the Colorado and Rio Grande rivers. One of the authors of the study says that water managers need to prepare themselves for the worst. The public can help mitigate threats to snowpacks by limiting contributions of greenhouse gas emissions.
On November 5th, 2 dams collapsed at the Germano mine in southeastern Brazil, leading to 9 deaths, 19 missing, and 500 displaced among massive environmental devastation. The mine, used to extract iron ore, let out millions of gallons of red-orange sludge, cutting off drinking water to nearly 250,000 Brazilians. President Dilma Rousseff compared the disaster to the 2010 BP oil spill in the Gulf of Mexico. Silt-saturated byproducts from mining is running down the Rio Doce, the Sweet River, along its tributaries, affecting rainforests and coastal shorelines alike. Aquatic life will have an especially hard time coping, according to experts. The beaches, expected to turn deep red, are home to endangered sea turtles. This is the latest in trauma on the Rio Doce, which, since being inhabited by indigenous people, has lived through industrial-level extraction and transport of minerals, as well as recent drought. A recent report was released entitled "The Risk, Public Liability, and Economics of Tailings Storage Facility Failure." In it, report co-author and director of the Center of Science in Public Participation, David Chambers, states, "Our research shows that more mining waste disasters like Brazil's Germano spill are inevitable. If mining practices continue as usual, we are going to see more severe spills more frequently. These spills each will cost the public hundreds of millions to billions of dollars to clean up, if cleanup is possible at all. And sometimes, like the Germano spill, they will cost people's lives."
The Israeli Prime Minister's visit to Washington last week included a meeting with President Obama, in which the two discussed the status of the Israeli-occupied Golan Heights. Israel invaded and occupied the Syrian territory known as the Golan Heights in 1967 and has maintained a military and civilian presence there ever since. But the Israeli claim on the territory has never been recognized by the international community. Now, according to some analysts, the Israeli government has a new reason to secure their illegal annexation of the Syrian land: oil. Last month, AFEC, an Israeli subsidiary of the U.S.-based Genai Energy, announced that discovery of a huge huge reserves of oil in the region. The company's chief geologist in Israel, Yuval Bartov, said the reserves could potentially hold billions of barrels of oil. The company's license to do exploratory drilling was renewed by the Israeli government for 2 years in October, shortly after the finding of the oil reserves. But the land on which the oil is located is actually Syrian territory, and despite the Israeli government claim to the oil and the licensing of 10 experimental wells, the discovery of oil in Golan may reignite the conflict between Israel and Syria over the control of the Golan Heights.
And now, the latest news and developments from the occupied territories in Palestine from the International Middle East Media Center in Bethlehem.
Welcome to Palestine Today, a service of the International Middle East Media Center at www.imamc.org for Tuesday, November 17th, 2015. One Palestinian youth killed and two in Jordan arrested by Israeli soldiers, and the government approves more homes in illegal settlements. These stories and more coming up. Stay tuned. Israeli forces have shot and killed a Palestinian youth during armed clashes north of Ramallah Tuesday evening, with two others injured in exchange of fire. The Palestinian Health Ministry said that the slain Palestinian has been identified as Muhammad Saleh, 24 years of age, from Ramallah. It added that the soldiers left Saleh bleeding on the ground for more than 1 hour and prevented Palestinian ambulances and medics from reaching him until he died of his wounds. The soldiers fired live rounds and gas bombs on Palestinians who tried to reach the Palestinian, and the army completely closed the Nablus-Ramallah road. The Israeli army said that the shots were fired from a pistol at an Israeli military patrol near Ramallah, with soldiers returning fire and shooting at the assailant. The gunfight started when three armed Palestinians had reportedly exited a vehicle near an Israeli military patrol and opened fire at soldiers near Turmus Ayya, north of Ramallah. Two Palestinians were injured in the gun battle and detained by Israeli forces. On Tuesday, the Palestinian Health Ministry has reported that following the death of Muhammad, the number of Palestinians killed by Israeli fire since October 1st has arrived to 89, including 18 children. According to the ministry report, 10,000 Palestinians have been injured in the same time period. In other news, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu on Tuesday approved the construction of 500 more illegal settlement units in Ramat Shlomo settlement in occupied East Jerusalem. The move, which sets the stage for 1,000 additional settlement units to be built, reportedly follows a two-year de facto freeze following a diplomatic row with the United States. It also comes in the midst of growing frustration and clashes in both occupied Jerusalem and the West Bank as a whole. Last Wednesday, the Israeli municipality in West Jerusalem approved the construction of 891 units in the Gilo settlement, which was constructed on Bethlehem territory in occupied West Bank. The day before, Netanyahu approved the construction of 2,200 settlement units in Ma'aleh Mukhmas settlement east of Ramallah. And that's all for today from the IMEMC News. This was the Tuesday, November 17th, 2015, news roundup from the occupied Palestinian territories. For more news and updates, please visit our website at www.imemc.org. Today's report has been brought to you by Jordan Shmawi and me, Ghassan Bannoura.
Listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Cliff Verla, Doug McVeigh, and Jared Dantzler, and Jim Thompson, and our engineer is Sequoina Wright, and the KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Jenka Soderberg. A podcast of local stories from this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. Or look for us on Twitter at KBOO News. You are listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River 91.9 FM. I'm Jared Dantzler.
And I'm Emily Young. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO at 7, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8 on Wednesday Talk Radio, host Paul Rowland speaks with social ecological economist, Clive Spash about the upcoming Paris Climate Talks. At 9 on Political Perspectives, host Stephanie Potter speaks with Salvatore Gencarel about his book, A Man Among the Helpers, and the disconnection disease that pervades modern society. At 10, Chris Andre hosts Air Cascadia Headlines, Interviews, and Commentary. At 10:15, it's Flashpoints, Investigative News Radio with host Dennis Bernstein. And at 11, Chris Siegel hosts The Food Show. Thanks, KBOO members, for your generous support. If you're not a current member, now is a great time to become one. Go to kboo.fm/give to find out about our matching grant.
And now, stay tuned for KBOO News in Depth. Doug McFay speaks with Rania Masri, an activist based in Beirut. The topic is the slanted media coverage of the Paris bombings. Good night, Emily.
Good night, Jared.